Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you today in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Our guest today, one of the truly giant figures of journalism in the United States today. It's a great honor and pleasure to have her. Our guest will be none other than Amy Goodman. But first, before we go to Amy Goodman, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
When Jon Stewart of Comedy Central's The Daily Show called out CNBC pundit Jim Cramer for touting stocks and tossing out softball questions to CEOs as the economy tanked and millions of jobs were lost, it was a cathartic experience for many viewers. But for Aaron Schwartz and Adam Green, it was a catalyst for a campaign to encourage CNBC to stop doing public relations for Wall Street and start being an aggressive watchdog for the financial system. Aaron Schwartz explains.
So the first thing we did was try and come up with an achievable goal, you know, something that would seem reasonable to the average person. So we decided that what we should do is try and demand CNBC hire someone who is right about the economic crisis and try and focus more on covering the problems with Wall Street instead of just sucking up to them.
Schwartz and Green started working their networks, which were already sizable. Schwartz is co-founder of the user-generated news site Reddit, and Green worked for MoveOn.org. They co-founded BoldProgressives.org, a political action committee dedicated to helping progressive candidates run for office. Using online social networking sites, their petition soon grew to 20,000 signatures. They called on Baratunde Thurston, a blogger, comedian, and editor at The Onion, to help them deliver the signatures to CNBC in New York and make a video about the event. CNBC accepted the petition without comment.
I think we presented a pretty reasonable demand. You know, just hire one, just one person who is actually right about the economic crisis to be on CNBC. You know, they're always complaining, oh, we can't be perfect. We have 24 hours to fill. You know, if they're so desperate to fill time on television, you'd think they would be glad to have someone like Dean Baker, who has been prescient on all of these economic issues for years. I mean, he was telling people that Fannie and Freddie were going to collapse and bring down the rest of the economy with them back in 2003. So you'd think it would not be an unreasonable request to ask them to have someone like that on their network.
For more information, go to fixcnbc.org.
Time Warner Cable has announced it will begin testing a new way of charging customers for their broadband use, by the byte. This summer, Time Warner customers in Austin and San Antonio, Texas, Rochester, New York, and Greensboro, North Carolina, will have to choose among limited usage plans that range between 5 to 100 gigabytes per month. The metered pricing was first floated in Beaumont, Texas, where Time Warner says it met with little resistance. But customers and politicians in the new test areas are already complaining about the change. New York Congressman Eric Massa vowed to stop the plan, calling it, quote, an incredibly ill-conceived idea and a very repressive step backwards. At the very moment when access to digital information is at the heart of economic recovery, they're going to go for corporate greed, he said. And in Austin, mayoral candidate Lee Leffingwell called the caps unrealistic and unreasonable. He warned the new pricing system would have a significant impact on anybody who uses the internet to watch videos, download music, movies, or television shows. John Gribble manages cable franchising for the city of Greensboro, North Carolina. He says that although there are other internet service providers in the area that offer DSL and satellite connections, Time Warner is the only high-speed broadband service in town.
Greensboro is similar to some of the other medium-sized cities in the nation where we have one cable provider. It can lead to concerns about regulation, and folks are concerned. They're concerned about the pricing.
But Gribble and Greensboro are powerless to stop rate changes due to changes in the law.
In 2006, the Video Services Competition Act was passed by the state, and this gave the regulatory authority to the state instead of the municipality. This was a bill that was pushed through by AT&T lobbyists. The cable providers also joined up with those folks to pass this into law.
Gribble says that the data caps are really a public policy issue. There are many local stakeholders, he says, and everyone needs to weigh in. But ultimately, it will have to be resolved at the federal level through Congress, the courts, or the FCC.
We'll have to work on this and see how this evolves in the near future, and I hope for the best.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you today on WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Our guest today is the founder and host, co-host of Democracy Now!, well known to many of our listeners, probably one of our most requested guests here on the program, and author of several books, including the new book, Standing Up to the Masses, which she wrote with her brother, David Goodman, which is just now coming out in paperback. Standing Up to the Madness. Excuse me, Amy. I can't even read my own handwriting here. Thank you so much for joining us, Amy Goodman.
It's great to be with you, Bob, and great to be with the listeners of WILL.
You know, I described you before we went on air as the James Brown of American journalism in reference to your work ethic. It truly is extraordinary. Not just what people see you do on the air, which alone would be, I think, a full-time job plus, but the books you write, the columns you write, and the tireless work you do on behalf of community media around the United States, which we'll talk about later in the program. So thank you for taking time from your very demanding schedule to talk with us here at WILL. You know, first of all, you just received last week in Ithaca, New York, the first Izzy Award, an award that you share with Glenn Greenwald. Glenn was our guest 2 weeks ago on the program. And, you know, I want for a second for some of our listeners who are unfamiliar with I.F. Stone, if you just talk a little bit about, you know, him, his legacy, and the type of journalism he stands for.
I mean, I.F. Stone was a leading muckraker of our time. And one of the things that you could say characterize him, aside from being an exception to the rulers, because that's certainly what he was lonely. Now, let me say what I mean by that, because when we had the event, his son, Jeremy Stone, talked about this. He was a true journalist. I.F. Stone ended up being very isolated because he was taking on all the powers that be. In 1953, at the height of the McCarthy era, at the height of the time of red baiting, he started I.F. Stone's Weekly. And that was such an important publication. Remember, we had no internet at the time. It's not like you can just write the articles and then they'll just get out. You have to publish them in the weekly. You have to get the weekly out. He didn't know how many people would be able to get it. He certainly didn't have a publicity machine. He said, on the strength of the articles, I'll just hope that people will want to get the I.F. Stone Weekly. And, you know, after 20 years, he had 70,000 subscribers because people knew authenticity. People knew what it meant. To really dig, to take on the powers that be. And that's what I.F. Stone was known for all of these years. He's taking on all the sacred cows. I mean, not only the politicians, he was taking on the press. He was a member of the National Press Club and resigned when they wouldn't allow African Americans in. He had to take on every institution. And it is remarkable that to be able to continue with that kind of philosophy that, you know, the press matter in this country. The press are supposed to be holding those in power accountable. And one of the famous quotes of I.F. Stone in teaching students about journalism is, "All governments lie." I think that's extremely important for people to understand. You don't just, you know, take down the words of the powerful and think you're a journalist. That's called a stenographer. It's our job to get behind what the politicians are putting out, to bring out the voices of the grassroots, people working in their communities, We need more IF stones today.
You know, Amy, as you were saying that, Amy Goodman, I was thinking about oftentimes when we talk usually once every 6 months or every year off air, and you oftentimes say to me, Bob, I think mainstream journalism has hit an all-time low. And then you describe some terrible coverage of a major story or lack of coverage of a major story that's going on. I'm just wondering, are we at an all-time low now?
We are. And let me go on and tell you why. You'd
okay.
think we'd already plumbed the depth. But I think the embedding process has brought us to an all-time low. That means, yes, and reporters embedded in the front lines of troops in Iraq and Afghanistan, what kind of perspective are you going to get of the war when you're sleeping with, eating with, when you're protected by the troops, if you don't also have people embedded in Iraqi and Afghan communities, Iraqi and Afghan hospitals, and now, of course, spreading into Pakistan, the expanded war, embedded in the peace movement around the world. Not to mention, even if you're not embedded in troops, the U.S. press corps embedded in the establishment. We have to be a part. We have to be not a part of, but apart from the establishment. We have to be there as a watchdog. Now we have newspapers all over the country dying, folding. And, Bob, you write about this as well, the death of American newspapers. Now, we have problems with our newspapers. There's no question about it. All too often, they iced out not the fringe minority opinion, but the opinions of the majority of people, like around the issue of war. There they were beating the drums for war. By repeating the false assertions of the Bush administration, weapons of mass destruction, when there was plenty of evidence out there that this was not the case. And then you have journalists today saying, well, how are we supposed to know? In fact, Glenn Greenwald talked about this in the award ceremony as reporters sort of made their name saying, our job is not to challenge. You know, we were there taking, accepting what the government was saying. No, that's not our job. There's a reason why our profession is the only one explicitly protected by the U.S. Constitution, journalism, because we're supposed to be the check and balance on power. We're supposed to investigate. And as we lose the newspapers of this country, one thing we will lose, I'm afraid of, unless we're very careful, is local coverage. And we'll also, what tends to happen online is less investigative pieces, shorter form pieces. We have to assure that those investigations continue. And now you might say, well, why would you say we're at an all-time low considering President Obama's talking about, you know, ending the war in Iraq? True. But he's also talking about expanding the war in Afghanistan. And even with the gradual schedule of withdrawal from Iraq, he hasn't talked about, and where are the reporters demanding to know at the news conferences, for example, will there be permanent military bases in Iraq? What's going to happen with the equal number of military contractors in Iraq? These issues haven't been addressed. And on the issue of Afghanistan, where are the voices in the corporate media as President Obama doesn't learn his own lessons, where he very bravely spoke out against war in Iraq? How is it that he wants to expand the war in Afghanistan, isolating us once again from the Western world, right? I mean, his first foreign trip was to Canada, and one of the things that was a bit of embarrassment that they tried to play down when the Obama administration went to Canada, when President Obama went to Canada, was that the Canadian Prime Minister, a very close Bush ally, Stephen Harper, actually, because of tremendous mounting pressure from the Canadian population, is pulling Canadian troops out of Afghanistan. And then he meets with the new Tony Blair, right, with Gordon Brown, the new Prime Minister of Britain. And he doesn't hold a stand-up news conference with him, which shocked the British press corps. They said that, well, because the snow was covering the Rose Garden. I actually think it was just a snow job because the British people are standing up against Afghanistan and war in Afghanistan. You know, as I take the 70-city tour, I'm traveling all over the country, began in the most depressed state in Michigan, in Grand Rapids. You know, the auto industry is just plummeting. And I was on the plane sitting next to a military consultant. He had been in the military and aerospace all his life. He retired and now is a military consultant. He was headed for Huntsville, Alabama. And as he talked about the depression in the auto industry, I asked him about, you know, the military corporations, and aren't they... well, isn't business booming? because President Obama has said they're expanding the war in Afghanistan. He said, yes, oh, yes, they're profiting handsomely. So I said, so you must feel pretty good. And he said, no, I'm an American, too. And his stance, this military consultant said about Obama, he said, his stance on Afghanistan baffles me, baffles many of us. He said, we can't win a war in Afghanistan. Don't care how many weapons they buy. He says, you look at the contrast in geography, you know, the mountains there, but not to mention, look at the history. You can't win war there. That shouldn't be the approach. And he said many in the military and the contractors feel that way. And I think it's our job to get the voices out of not the fringe minority, but the silenced majority, silenced by the corporate media.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Amy Goodman, who you've been listening to. Amy Goodman, the co-founder and the co-host of Democracy Now!, the radio television program seen and heard on 750 different public and community radio and television stations around the country, including right here in Champaign-Urbana. I know many of you are faithful listeners and viewers of the program. Plus, you can go to the democracynow.org website, which is constantly updated and has all sorts of material. Amy Goodman, the author of several books, including now the paperback version of her latest book that she co-authored with her brother David Goodman, Standing Up to the Madness, which is now out. We're talking to Amy Goodman on a pre-recorded program. We taped this a little over a week before going on air, so please don't call in today. Sit back, relax, let Amy and myself do the yakking. And Amy, I must say before I forget, I'm doing some research for the show. I noticed that tomorrow is your birthday, so happy birthday.
Oh, my gosh. Well, thank you very much. And also, this week is a very important birthday. On April 15th, 60 years ago, 1949, Pacifico Radio went on the air. And I'll be in Berkeley, California in just a few days, the evening of April 15th, to celebrate Pacifica's 60th birthday. It's an amazing accomplishment.
It really is. And you know, I don't want to go too far off track on that, but I do think it's important because I think most Americans are familiar with the notion of public broadcasting, and it, as we have with the NPR stations like this one, WILL AM 580, and they're familiar with notions of the CBC and the BBC, and most other countries have public broadcasting. But Pacifica truly is a revolutionary understanding of how to do broadcasting. Talk a little bit about what was so unique and special about Pacifica's model.
Well, it was founded by Lou Hill, a war resistor, who, when he came out of the detention camp, said there's got to be a media outlet not run by corporations that profit from war, but run by journalists and artists. In order to hear the KPFA first station in Berkeley, FM was in its infancy, you had to get a special radio called the subscriber, and then you tune in and you'd hear people begging for money. It wasn't a very auspicious beginning. But the idea was that they wouldn't take money from advertisers, but just from the listeners. And it grew. You know, KPFK in Los Angeles came 10 years later, my station, New York, BAI, in 1960. 1970 was KPFT in Houston, and 1977 WPFW. But I think the important thing here, as we kind of come full circle with the death of American newspapers, or, you know, the very serious challenge to American newspapers right now, is look at the legislation that's been introduced into Congress and some of the states like Vermont, and that is that newspapers serve a public service and that they should have some kind of nonprofit status. They're really using the model of public broadcasters, and mm-hmm. the pioneer in public broadcasting, you know, NPR and PBS took up the model of Pacifica, and that was the idea of listener sponsorship.
Indeed. You know, let's go back, if we can, Amy Goodman, to what you were talking about before, the state of conventional news media. And the reason I was thinking of that is I was watching a couple of weeks ago the press conference that the Washington Press Corps had with President Obama. And I was struck, frankly, with how pathetic the questions were, to be honest, and just how few of them really forced the president to explain much. And a lot of them are sort of the really gotcha sort of stuff that is nonsensical. And when I was watching that, and you may disagree with my assessment of the press conference, I don't know. But what I also thought of was that moment you had in the 2000 presidential election. I think it was on election day, if I'm not mistaken, when you were at the dials at WBI when President Clinton called in, and I guess he had a list of numbers to call of radio stations around the country, probably primarily in Democratic states, urging people to go out and vote. And you managed to sort of corral him for a half hour for the one-on-one interview. And I'd like you to talk about that, because the reason why I'm raising the issue is I think it was probably one of the few instances in which a president of the United States has actually been asked the sort of questions that journalists ought to be asking a president of the United States. So talk a little bit about that episode.
You know, you may be even able to play a little of it here, but it was very interesting. It was Election Day 2000. The reason he was calling New York stations, you know, he's a sitting president, President Clinton, is because he was pushing people to get out to vote for Hillary Clinton, running for Senate in New York, for Al Gore, of course, as well as president. And we got a call right before broadcast saying the president wants to come on. I thought it was a hoax. They said, this is the White House calling. And I thought they said White Horse, which is a famous tavern.
Yeah, I've been there.
Oh, okay, so you know, in the Village.
Yeah.
And so they said, I said, the president of the tavern? They're calling at 9 in the morning? And they said, the president of the United States. So I said, oh, and first I had to figure out if it's a prank call. And then I said, right, sure. I gave them the internal number. Mm-hmm. I said, okay, sure, he could call in. And, you know, I ran in. The music was swelling. The show was on. We already had the show booked. I didn't really believe the president would call in. And I had to say to the producers, by the way, don't hang up. If someone who says he's the president of the United States calling, it really is. And they looked at me like I was definitely off my gourd. And he did not call in. And they definitely thought I was crazy at the end of the show. And we were going out for coffee because this was going to be a long day. It was election day. And someone screamed from the control room, the president is on the phone. So he called right after the show. So now we're local on a Latino music show. And Gonzalo Alberto was at the controls. He does this great music show on community station VAI. And they said, come in. I ran in. He was paralyzed. All the music faders were up. But so was the phone line. And you hear President Clinton shouting, hello, hello, is anyone there above the salsa music? So I leaped over the audio board. I have no idea which faders are which. I throw down all the music faders, and I picked up every microphone in the room. I put up the fader. That's like 7 mics. The room was hot. Let's put it that way. If you moved, if you fixed your tie, if you zipped your jacket, it would be heard in a resounding way with all the mics on. And there was President Clinton. He said, is anyone there? Is anyone there? And I said, yes, President Clinton. I understand you're calling people to get out the vote, and I was wondering why people should vote. A lot of people are asking, wondering if, you know, the corporations have captured both the Democratic and the Republican parties. And he launched in, and he explained why he felt people should vote. And he was still on the line, so I asked him, it was the first time he was asked about whether he'd be granting Leonard Peltier, the Native American leader, clemency, because I knew he was weighing that. And Gonzalo joined in, and we asked all sorts of questions about the napalming of and bombing of the island of Vieques. The Navy was doing that at the time. We asked about the sanctions against Iraq that both Assistant Secretary Generals had quit in charge of those sanctions, saying they were genocidal. Asked him about racial profiling. Al Gore had said it would be his first act in office to end it. And I said, but you guys have been in office for 8 years. Why haven't you issued an executive order in that time? You know, those kinds of questions. And President Clinton obliged. He really got in there. Then I asked him if, you know, at the time, Ralph Nader, people were very concerned about in 2000, if he wasn't responsible for Ralph Nader's success by shifting the Democratic Party to the right. And he got really mad then, and he called me hostile, combative, maybe at times disrespectful.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I'm just asking you some critical questions. I just have a few more questions for you. So that's how the conversation went, and it went on for half an hour. We played it on Democracy Now! The next day. It was live on the music show at that time. And after we played it, the White House called and said I would be banned from the White House. And I said, why? He called me. I didn't call him. And they said, we said he was willing to talk about getting out the vote. And I said, well, I didn't accept those ground rules. And I said, how many stations did you call? And they said, 40. And I said, they all just stuck to that? They said, yes. I said, it's a sad comment on American journalism. We had made no previous agreement.
Well, it also reminded me, Amy Goodman, of the experience that President George W. Bush had, I think, midway through his two terms in office, when he went to Europe and he was granted an audience with a leading Irish public broadcaster, a journalist. She was sort of, I think, the Bill Moyer, so to speak, of Ireland, very highly regarded. And in the interview, a one-on-one interview, when President Bush would give his answer, she was very knowledgeable and she would challenge him on it and provide facts. And I guess it was the most uneasy experience of the Bush presidency. He hated the experience and he said, I never want to talk to her again. And as the wags were saying afterwards, it was the first time he'd ever been really had to deal with an honest journalist who was going to do their homework and not back down. And, I think both those episodes, yours and that one, point to the fact that people in power really don't have to answer for that much to the Washington Press Corps or to our leading political journalists.
Right. I mean, our journalists, the journalists of the United States, are too often engaged in the access of evil, and that is trading truth for access. You see it over and over again, the pride that one of them gets called on. But what is the trade-off? They know that they will not ask a really tough question. And remember, politicians need journalists more than journalists need politicians.
Absolutely. Our guest today, Amy Goodman, the co-founder and co-host of Democracy Now!, which can be seen and heard all over the nation on 750 different radio and television stations, including right here in Urbana. Likewise, she's a newspaper columnist and the author of three books, most recently a book co-authored with her brother David Goodman, Standing Up to the Madness, which is now out and available in paperback. The democracynow.org website is a must-stop for people interested in the journalism that she is doing. And you are not the only host on Democracy Now! Your co-host is Juan Gonzalez. What's Juan like? What's his background, and what's it like working with him?
Oh, I mean, Juan is a remarkable journalist. He is a longtime journalist, began his journalism career in Philadelphia with the Philadelphia Daily News. He became the president of the National Association of Hispanic Journalists. He is really one of the leading journalists of our time, and I highly encourage people to get his forthcoming book, about the history of the media in this country, particularly as it relates to people of color, the whiting out of the media. It is so important that we really understand how journalism began. And this goes to Bob, and I wish you would talk about it. You know, when we had you on last week on Democracy Now!, the whole issue of the males, one of the things Juan has always talked about is how the mail was really set up to get out newspapers, and you say we should go back to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we had Juan on the program before, and when that book comes out, we will certainly have him on for a full hour to talk about it, because I agree, his work is really cutting-edge stuff. You know, one thing I forgot to mention, Amy Goodman, before, you know, we mentioned you won the Izzy Award. You know, you really have become an extraordinarily decorated journalist in your career. You've won the Robert F. Kennedy Award, if I'm not mistaken. You have won the George Polk Award. And the Right Livelihood Award, which is called the Alternative Nobel Prize, the first journalist ever to be given that award. I think these are extraordinary accomplishments.
Well, I mean, the Right Livelihood Award was an amazing moment. I went to Sweden. It's given out in the Swedish Parliament. It was Nobel Week in December. And to broadcast Democracy Now! 2 days from Stockholm, 1 day from Hamburg, and 1 day from Berlin was an amazing week. In Stockholm, and I think it goes to the issue of community media, you know, Democracy Now! Broadcasts throughout Sweden every day, not only on radio, believe it or not, but on television, because we have perfected a way through open source technology of sending broadcasts through the Internet that are equal to in quality what the networks send over satellites, which cost millions of dollars when you send that around the world.
In technical quality, yeah.
Yes, in technical quality, so you could watch. It doesn't look like a webcast on TV. It looks like a perfect broadcast quality. But, you know, I had an amazing moment. It was a commercial station in Stockholm where we were broadcasting Democracy Now!, and I always think it's important to get out of the United States to give people a picture of what another world can look like. For example, Sweden, around the issue of national health care, how they deal with war, to understand how there can be a difference. And We had on these two young women who were engaged in sort of plowshares actions. You don't think of Sweden as having Sweden has the second largest arms export industry per capita in the world. Yes, arms export. It gives out the Nobel Peace Prize. Alfred Nobel began it. Bofors is the place where a lot of the weapons are made, and it's the name of the weapons company. And these young women were challenging the weapons industry of Sweden, and they were hammering on weapons, you know, like the plowshares activists do in the United States, like Dan Berrigan. And we brought them into the commercial studio, and we had on the curator of the Nobel Museum. We had on an Iraqi immigrant reporter who was talking about what immigrants suffer in Sweden. Very different picture than you'd think. And afterwards, you know, all the commercial cameramen were there. We just had gone into a commercial studio, and I said, so you must meet these kind of people all the time. And they said, never. This older guy said, never. And he said, and it's been fascinating. I said, what did you think of those young women who were facing jail for defacing a weapon in Sweden? And he said, I do not agree with them. I just don't. But I really appreciated hearing for the first time, and this took an American journalist coming into Sweden, he said, for the first time, hearing why they do what they do. And, you know, that's the power of media. That is the power of media as a force for peace, the most powerful force for peace. It's not that you have to agree with someone you hear, but listening to them, you understand the perspective they come from. You understand their world. And I think that's the beginning of building bridges. We need a media that builds bridges between communities, doesn't advocate the bombing of bridges.
I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters and WILL AM 580. Our guest today, Amy Goodman, co-host of Democracy Now!, columnist, journalist, author of the new book with her brother David Goodman, Standing Up to the Madness. A pleasure to have her with us today. Unfortunately for our listeners, this is a pre-recorded show. We taped it roughly a week before going on air April 12th, so please don't call in. Just sit back, relax, and let us do the talking. Amy, when you're abroad, what is the sense that you pick up on the attitude of people around the world to the Bush-Cheney administration and what their reign in power was like? And I'm asking this sort of as a preface to get to the story you've been covering, predominantly in the news media, which is Cy Hirsch's allegations that the government was engaged in running a death squad.
Oh, I mean, this is so important. I think, for example, of O'Mary Robinson. She's the former president of Ireland. She's the former head of the High Commissioner for Human Rights. And we had her in studio a little while ago, and I asked her about President Obama's stance, saying we have to just move forward, not backward, when we look at issues like should the Bush administration be held accountable for war crimes. And Mary Robinson said, in order to move forward, you have to take account. You have to hold people accountable, or people in the future will do what people did in the past. And it especially matters when you're talking about the most powerful person on earth. But when you're talking about Seymour Hersh, this is an absolutely critical issue. On this Standing Up to the Madness tour, as we celebrate community media around the country, my third stop was in Washington, D.C. at Georgetown, which is a Jesuit university. And I spoke with Seymour Hersh at the university, and they were honoring Dan Berrigan, who is a Jesuit priest, the plowshares activist, who's, you know, getting older and not doing so well, but his legacy is quite remarkable. And Seymour Hersh, we talked on the show the next day about these allegations. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist, the one known for exposing the My Lai massacre in Vietnam. And he created a stir earlier this month when he said the Bush administration ran an executive assassination ring that reported directly to Vice President Cheney. He said under President Bush's authority, they've been going into countries, not talking to the ambassador or to the CIA station chief, and finding people on a list and executing them and leaving, he said. That's what he told us on Democracy Now! He actually hadn't written about this as much. What he had done is talked about it in speeches. And this is chilling stuff, and it has to be investigated.
Yeah, what has been, you know, what's interesting, that came out several weeks ago now, that speech he originally gave in Minnesota where it came up. And, I tuned into the news media expecting to see this become a fairly important story. I mean, if Hugo Chavez was accused of that, I suspect it would be a dominant story in the New York Times and Washington Post. You know, just wondering, our own government is accused of assassinating people illegally, or I don't know if you can legally assassinate them, but assassinating people. It just isn't a story at all.
I mean, it's an astounding story. And, you know, he also went on CNN after he made that charge, and John Hanna responded, who was a top official, Dick Cheney's former national security advisor, where John Hanna said, there's no question that in a theater of war, when we're at war, when there's no doubt we're still at war against al-Qaeda. He said, our troops have the authority to go after and capture and kill the enemy, including the leadership of the enemy. But, you know, Cy Hirsch made clear, he said, it's not only contrary, it's illegal, it's immoral. He said, it's counterproductive. He said, when you look at what John Hanna said, he said, I think of us being the senior national security advisor, if not the chief of staff or Dick Cheney. What he said simply is, yes, we go after people suspected. That was the word he used, of crimes against America. And Cy Hirsch said, I have to tell you, there's an executive order signed by Gerry Ford, President Ford, in the 70s, forbidding such action. He said, the evidence, the problem with having military go kill people when they're not directly in combat, these are asking American troops to go out there, find people, and they go into countries without telling any of the authorities, and certainly nobody in the government that we're going into. And it's far more than in just combat areas. There's more than a dozen countries, and perhaps more. The president's authorized these kinds of actions in Latin America, throughout Europe, in the Middle East. Our boys have been told they can go and take the kind of executive action they need, and there's no legal basis for this. This should be a drumbeat in Washington right now. He talked about a special ring, the Joint Special Operations Command, JSOC, as it's known, operating out of Florida, involving a lot of wings. One of the units that work under the umbrella of Special Operations Command is JSOC, Special Unit. It's a group of elite people that include Navy SEALs, Delta Force, what we call our black units, the commando units. Commando, the word they don't like, but that's what we, most of us, refer to them as. And they promote from within. It's a unit that has its own promotion structure. And it's about getting ahead in promotion is the number of kills you have. It's basically devised, he said. It's been transmogrified into this unit that goes after, quote, high-value targets. It's the idea of an assassination ring. He said assassination wing that reports to Cheney was simply that they clear lists through the vice president's office. They clear the lists. He's certainly not deeply involved, but in the beginning very closely involved, this elite unit. It should be a question that's asked every day because we're not only talking about President Bush now, and that there has to be a holding to account because we may well be talking about war crimes. But is it also happening under President Obama? We can't answer this question at this point.
And again, the journalist making these charges, Seymour Hersh, is probably one of the most respected investigative journalists of our times, who has a very high batting average for accuracy. So it's not like these are just being pulled out of the sky by someone on a bar stool.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this guy has won like 5 George Polk Awards. He's won the Pulitzer Prize.
Amy Goodman, who are the other journalists working today, not just in the United States, but globally, that you look to as, like Cy Hirsch or others, as the people who are breaking the important stories, who are going to the places that need to be gone to get to the stories that are important for people in a democracy?
I mean, immediately comes to mind is someone like Robert Fisk, Middle East correspondent for the Guardian newspaper, for the Independent of London. He has, I mean, talking about bravery, almost killed in Afghanistan by an angry mob after the community had been bombed by the United States. He has been in Iraq I don't know how many times, broken one story after another, the first to call Iraq a quagmire. I really encourage people to read his books, The Art of War, Pity the Nation, about the abduction of Lebanon. John Pilger, an astounding journalist from Australia, lives in Britain, covered Cambodia, covered East Timor, and covered Palestine and Israel, covered Iraq over and over again. You know, young journalist Jeremy Scahill, who started out of Democracy Now!, I can't say enough about what he accomplished with Blackwater, you know, the company now known as ZXE.
Yeah, we had Jeremy on the show, so yeah, our listeners are familiar with him.
Right, and understanding what it means to frame the story, and for an independent journalist to have done this. Here you had Blackwater. His book is called Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. But he got out there first, and he talked about this mercenary company so that when the shootings happened at Nisour Square, I remember the day, I remember when it happened, when I was watching CNN and a senior producer, I don't even know who she was now, got on and said, it's not as it looks. I've been talking to high-level sources, not even after a while making it clear that she's talking to people within Blackwater saying, it wasn't just a unprovoked shooting. It was astounding to watch. But for the first time, there was something out there that was already framing the story, and that was Jeremy's book. And this powerful corporation, this military mercenary company that grew out of the Great Dismal Swamp of North Carolina, its head, Eric Prince, was not the one to frame the story anymore because there was a counter-narrative out there. Mm-hmm. They would have been the only one. And so it changed everything. And interestingly, when the paperback of Jeremy's book, Blackwater, came out, it was supposed to be coming out on the same day as Eric Prince's autobiography. That book never emerged. Because I think they were very clear that now, for the first time, it wouldn't just be Eric Prince being invited onto all the networks. There was this counter-narrative. They'd have to invite Jeremy Scahill as well. And Blackwater, no matter how powerful, no matter how many millions of dollars they'd gotten from the U.S. government and the State Department, for their mercenaries in Iraq that had ended up killing I don't know how many Iraqis, there would be a counter story there. And now he has stepped down as head of the company. And they've rebranded it as ZXE.
Jeremy Scahill, like yourself, Amy Goodman, was not trained in journalism at a journalism school, did not come up through the mainstream media system, but rather through community radio, like you at WBAI. And probably, I'm willing to bet, like you, did not have a very significant income for the first several years they were learning their craft and doing their work, or both of you. And this leads to a question I get all the time, and I suspect you get it too. Young people who are very interested in doing journalism, but very frustrated by the limitations the mainstream puts on their ability to do the sort of work they want to do. And are despondently asking me, what can I do? How can I be a journalist in this environment? And I suspect you've heard that question more than once, and I just wonder—I wonder what you tell those young people who talk to you about that.
I just say you're going to find your way. If you're passionate about this, if you deeply believe in independent journalism, you're going to find your way. I think of walking several decades ago down the streets of New York with another young journalist who said, how can I make this not just a hobby, but actually make this my profession, make a living? It was David Isay. And Dave is... started at BAI in New York. I trained him in the newsroom. He went on to NPR. And he has the astounding ability to simply let people tell their stories. And now he's doing the largest oral history project in this country. It's called StoryCorps. And he has trucks, he has buses going around the country that have little audio booths in them where you can interview anyone you want, right? Your mom, your dad, your teacher, your partner. And these our interviews are then being archived at the Library of Congress. And he's got the GRIO History Project, African Americans telling their stories. He has the World Trade Center 9/11 Project, people from 9/11 talking to each other. And this is the power of independent media, and that is people speaking for themselves. And this is an enormous project now. More than 100 people are employed doing it. And I do think you will find your way. I do think, especially with the Internet now, the sky is the limit. We don't know all the formations it will take. But if you're dedicated to getting at the truth, to ensuring there's a forum for people to speak for themselves, I think you'll find your way.
I think the problem is a material one, too, for lots of people. They simply need to, pay bills and have a place to sleep. And it seems like being a journalist is almost like what it used to be a dancer 40 years ago. It takes that sort of passion and commitment and stick-to-itiveness to get through the rough years to make it to the other side in a position where you can actually do it full-time and support yourself.
Right. I mean, just keep at it. That's all I can say. I started at WBAI, at community radio, and started in the newsroom. And you don't know the directions things will lead you in, but take yourself seriously. You know, laugh too, but really be committed. And, I mean, look at Glenn Greenwald, who you just had on.
Mm-hmm.
Glenn, yes, he trained as a lawyer, but now he is a blogger. He writes for Salon.com, and more people are turning to his work. He is dedicated to it. He's keeping at it.
Absolutely. Our guest, Amy Goodman, here on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Again, this is a pre-recorded program. We taped it roughly a week or so before going on air. So sit back, relax, let us do the talking today. Amy, one of the biggest stories perhaps of our times, and there's a lot that go near the top of that list, but certainly one that has a chance to be the defining story of our decade or our generation, much like the Depression was for my parents and probably your grandparents. What the economic crisis, how do you think this has been covered by the news media? What do you think the issues are regarding the economic crisis that need to get more attention than they're currently getting?
Well, first of all, who is getting bailed out and who isn't is an absolutely critical question. Those hit hardest get no bailout. That was the column I did just a week ago. And by the way, your local newspaper can run the column. It's distributed by King Feasters. And it really just takes, like getting on community radio, public television, Democracy Now!, it just takes calling your local newspaper. Because editorial pages of newspapers are supposed to be, you know, a robust place for debate. But we're talking about, in this column, taxpayers' bailout money we know about for AIG bonuses that provoke this massive backlash. But the U.S. public now owns like 80% of AIG. The outrage was bipartisan. You had Senator Grassley, the Iowa Republican, suggesting AIG executives resign or go commit suicide. You had our New York State Attorney General Andrew Cuomo releasing details on the bonuses, exposing AIG's ridiculous claim that they were retention bonuses aimed at keeping employees, since 11 of those who received more than $1 million are no longer employed by AIG. They quit. And then you have the whole issue of not just the bonuses. You know, that has really hooked into something Americans can understand, because, you know, people get salaries or they don't. But that's just a small fraction of the hundreds of millions of dollars in various stimulus packages and bailouts that don't find their way to regular people, but they find their way to corporations deemed too big to fail, leaving behind millions of people who are, what, apparently small enough to fail? The Center for Social Inclusion, we had on Maya Wiley, and this really shows the difference between, I think, Democracy Now! It's a very interesting group, and they had just done a report on how the economic meltdown affects, is linked to race as well, to the lack of opportunity, to the prevalence of the so-called, well, notorious subprime mortgages that triggered the economic crisis. She said, we have to stimulate equality in order to stimulate the economy. Access to education, transportation, housing, a clean environment, give people a firm footing to respond to crisis and to succeed. She talks about the shovel-ready stimulus jobs in construction, how they'll disproportionately favor those who are already in that industry, predominantly white males. So she, Maya Wiley of the Center for Social Inclusion, is pushing for community benefits agreements for construction jobs that ensure when the government has construction contracts, low-income people, people of color, women, are going to have a fair share of those jobs. She said we have to ensure that the wave dollars go to transit, mass transit, to connect people who need jobs to the places where there are jobs. We have to talk about who's benefiting and who isn't. I mean, it is astounding. Juan also wrote about this in the New York Daily News, Juan Gonzalez, how AIG was used as a funnel. It gets billions in bailout money. And then we learn this new word, counterparties. They give billions of that money to foreign companies, not only to Goldman Sachs. You think we know how much Goldman Sachs got? We didn't know the backroom bailout, that they got a lot of money through AIG, but also UBS. UBS is the Swiss company that had to pay a criminal fine. I mean, this is an amazing story. which offers secret bank accounts that allow the richest Americans to avoid taxes. In effect, beleaguered U.S. taxpayers are bailing out wealthy U.S. tax dodgers. We got to know these stories. Who is getting wealthy and who is getting even poorer? And this is what the stimulus, some of the stimulus and the bailouts have gone to do. Who's too big to fail and who's just tiny enough to fail?
This has perplexed me, this very issue, and I've been writing a little bit about it as well. Isn't this a bigger issue? I mean, I would think that even a mainstream newsroom, that would be like, wow, this is a great story. I'm so lucky to be born this generation when I get to cover this incredibly important public policy story, yet it's not getting very much attention. What's your explanation for that?
Well, again, it's who's in power, who's in the media that is covering this. They identify with the elite, and so they are, in a sense, siding with the elite. You know, very early on, we had on an organization in Boston called NACA. And this is an organization of homeowners or of people who are being foreclosed on. And it has been very interesting. We had on Marcy Kaptur and Bruce Marks, who's the CEO of Credit Assistance Corporation of America, who is pressuring Fannie Mae to restructure thousands of troubled mortgages. We had him on really early on. And he was saying the answer here, before all the bailouts, is to stop the hemorrhaging, stop foreclosures. That's a very important story. It's all based on these subprime mortgage failures, so stop. This was before anyone was saying that, and now more and more people are saying that. Marcy Kaptur was fascinating. You know, Marcy Kaptur, who's the Ohio congressmember, the oldest Democratic congresswoman, the longest-serving Democratic congresswoman in history. And she had a very interesting proposal, and that was produce the note. And she said that you have these mortgages that are being taken over by companies and then resold and repackaged. You should say, if you're facing foreclosure, this is a U.S. congresswoman saying this, she produced the note. Don't leave, squat in your own house. It's a really fascinating idea because losses, you've got to produce the mortgage, show it to us before you can send us out of our homes. You know, how it works is the bailout failures protect homeowners. Those facing foreclosure make this demand of the note. She said, possession is 9/10 of the law. Therefore, stay in your property, get proper legal representation. If Wall Street cannot produce the deed nor the mortgage audit trail, you should stay in your home. It's your castle. It's more than a piece of property. Most people don't even think about getting representation because they get a piece of paper from the bank and they go, oh, my God, it's the bank. They become fearful. Rather than saying, this is contract law. The mortgage is a contract. I'm one party. There's another party. What are my legal rights under the law as a property owner? If you look at the bad paper, if you look at where there's trouble, 95 to 98% of the paper really has moved to five institutions. J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, Wachovia, Citigroup, HSBC, they have this country held by the neck. I mean, that's really an interesting idea. They showed me the note. Show me the mortgage. It's been sold so many times, they probably don't even have it.
Mm-hmm. Amy Goodman, our guest today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580. We've only got a few minutes left, and again, not taking calls today. We pre-recorded this program. Amy, before we go, let's imagine you had the resources to command a large newsroom of really excellent journalists. You had an immense army of talented journalists working with you. And what would be the sort of stories you'd like to see covered that aren't being covered now?
Well, really, Democracy Now! Is a brain trust of those remarkable reporters and producers. And most importantly, I say we've got to cover war. There's no more serious action a country can engage in than going to war. We need on the front pages of our newspapers, the top of our newscasts on a regular basis, as long as men and women are being sent to kill or be killed, we need to cover war. We need to cover what's happening in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Pakistan, because the U.S. is involved there. I mean, that's our responsibility. And we also have to cover health care in this country. This is a key moment. 75 years after the Depression, Frances Perkins, the remarkable Secretary of Labor, got so much pushed through, like Social Security, unemployment benefits. One area she failed was national health care. There is nothing that more directly affects more people in this country than being ripped off by health insurance companies or not being covered at all. If we're talking national security, we have to talk about the health of this nation. And that is a critical issue to get on paper, to get in the newscast every single day, an understanding of what single-payer health care is, what it means to guarantee health care as a right. FAIR did a study of the week leading up to the White House Health Care Summit. There was almost no representation of the single-payer point of view in the corporate media, on newspapers or on the networks, except someone blasting single-payer. What does it mean for government to provide health care? It means you've got private doctors who are there ensuring you have a choice, you're covered, your kids are covered, whether you have all the fortune in the world or you are poor. But that's one thing, like firefighting, like police, like education in this country, you have a right to good health care in the most powerful country on earth, and we've got to start representing what that story is all about.
You know, Amy Goodman, I think it was early in Barack Obama's presidential run, before, obviously before the election, and I think even possibly before the first primary, that in talking about health care, he said, you know, obviously if we were starting from scratch, we would have a single-payer system. That's the only rational system. But we are starting from scratch. We have this huge insurance industry, and they're politically too powerful to mess with, so we can't consider single-payer. We have to somehow work out a deal just to include these guys in and deal them in to make money, even though they aren't a productive part of the industry or out of the healthcare system. And it seems that, you know, that was a strange acknowledgement he made. I think he never made that one again after that. He told to cool off on that one. But should journalists cool off just because the president says politically it's not possible?
No, absolutely not. And I don't even necessarily know that Obama would oppose what people are proposing. It just thinks it's unrealistic. We just played tape of Obama in 2002 saying he supports not universal health care, which can be all sorts of private health insurance that rips people off. He said, I support single payer. Well, you're right. Now it's 7 years later, and he's saying, well, that's not possible. But whoever thought everything that we're dealing with today would be possible? If we're concerned about the financial health care of this country, we certainly should be concerned with people's health care and have an honest, robust discussion about what it means to provide health care for everyone in this country. I don't think it's up to the man in the White House, frankly. I think it's up to people all over this country making a demand. And now a plug for Standing Up to the Madness, my book. It's all about ordinary heroes in extraordinary times. It's about people in this country who are standing up. They don't wait for one public official, one politician to do something, take a wait-and-see attitude. They are there standing up for justice in their communities, and I think that's what people have to think about, not looking to who's in Washington in the White House, but what they can do in their communities that can make a difference, not only for this country, but for the world.
Amy Goodman, on that note, it's an excellent note. I think it's time for us to come to a close as the band is tuning up in the background to bring in the next show. It's really been a pleasure and an honor to have you on Media Matters today.
It's been really great to be with you, and thank you, Bob, for all of your work to ensure that we have a public media in this country, that we have free and fair access, open access to the internet, for all the pioneering work you've done, not only the history of the media, but understanding that to ensure public media in the future.
Well, thank you. Thanks right back at you then, Amy Goodman. And I want to thank Mike Pritchard for engineering today's program, Andrew Boyle, my producer. And we'll be back 1 week from today in 166 hours with our special two-hour pledge drive show. Everyone tune in. It's going to be a great show. And I'll talk to you then. Have a great week until then. Bye-bye, everyone.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
Mostly sunny is the forecast for today in and around Champaign-Urbana with a high of 48. Mostly cloudy tonight with a chance of rain after midnight, low of 40. And then tomorrow, showers and scattered thunderstorms likely. Cooler with a high in the upper 40s. Things will clear up by Tuesday. Winds today out of the east at 10 to 15, east at 15 tonight, east at 10 to 15 again tomorrow. You are listening to WILL, AM 580 and FM 90.9, HD2 and HD3 Urbana.